town and rainfall at the same time. Another example, temperature and Waterloo here, and stock market price in China. Well, you laugh, but maybe they are related somehow. Now, a famous case is from northern Germany, so people find out that the number of firsts in some town were closely related to the number of storks. Okay, but to become more serious again, of course, this standard problem mechanism is the relation between a drug administer and the health take, the person. So I hope there's no need to convince you that interrelations, interdependencies between us are of great importance. Now, in particular, once you know how objects or how measurements are related, then you have some notion of distance between them. And then we can start to cluster. And clustering is very closely related to classification. But so I will today give two examples. One from classification, and the other from something which is less intuitive, but not much less important, although it's, well, I wouldn't say less important, but has still a wide range of implications. And that is, assume you have some signals which you measure, and you know that these signals come from various sources. The famous example is the so-called argument problem. So you are in the evening, you are already tired, and there are lots of people talking around you, and you want to listen to that guy. So you have, from all the noise, from all these input streams which come to your ear, you want to filter out one particular component. And more generally, there's something which plays a big role in many applications, and I hope I will come to you one of those applications. Is so you have some signals and you want to decompose them. And how do you decompose them? I mean, what criteria is that the presumed sources into which the decompose them, the presumed independence, are independent. And because that's what you want. You want to assume that if Mr. A in your apartment does not talk independently of Lady L, then you have no chance to disentangle what they're saying. It's only if there's some degree of independence. And what you can do is you can just try to decompose so that the sources are as independent as possible. And that is something which, as I said, has a number of applications. But let me now come to the next point. Everyone might say, well, of course I know how to measure dependencies. One way is the correlation coefficient. You have two parties, A and B, and the correlation, the cross-correlation coefficient, is defined in that way. But it only captures linear correlations. So in the left-hand side, the correlation coefficient is perfectly okay as a measure of dependencies. On the right-hand side, you are completely fail, because obviously there is some relationship between them. Yeah, they lie on this sort of circle, but you can't see this on the correlation coefficient. Now what you need is, you need some universal dependency measure, or interdependency. And there is, I think, one which is really, on the one hand, universal in the sense that it captures all dependencies which might be. It has a very strong and very interesting information theory background, and this is the mutual information. Now, when I say information theory background, I immediately have to say that nowadays, today, there are essentially two parallel versions of information theory. One is the one starting with Shannon, which uses probabilistic concepts. So there you don't talk about the information associated with a single observation, but with the average observation. And the entropy, which is the central object here, is not a property of some observation, but it's a property of a random variable, so of an ensemble, so of a second form positive observation. The other argument theory is algorithmic, and is associated with the name Kolmogorov, Chaikin, and others, Sometimes it's called complexity theory, but actually it is S squared in particular, which I mean really an information theory. And one interesting aspect is that functional information can be formulated here and can be formulated here. The details look different, but much of the concepts are really the same. And I want to give examples from both. But first, let me just come to sharing information theory, just a review, because I assume that most of you have at least covered a little bit of information. And then, so, a short review of Shannon theory. Very short. So, let me assume that x and y are random variables. And let me, moreover, assume for the moment that x and y are discrete. So, I can count the possible outcomes of an experiment where I measure x, x1, x2, etc. And I can make a sum over the outcomes, sum over I, or xi. P of xi is the probability that in an experiment I will measure xi. Oh, sorry. Ah, I see. So this is the probability for measuring xi. And this famous expression, sum of all I, P, xi, or xi, is the, you might also say, Boltzmann or Shannon entropy. After evaluation is defined in this way, namely, it's the entropy of the random variable x plus the entropy of the random variable y minus the entropy of the joint. Now, why is this of interest? Assume x is male or female, such a gender. Y is the weight in kilogram. Now, if you want to say this guy is male and has 90 kilograms, you need a certain information. If you say she is female and has 60 kilograms, you need some other. Now, the point is that men are usually more heavy than women. So if you say he's male, then you know already that more likely something 80 or higher than 50 or lower. So you know that you can code more efficiently the weight if you know the sex. And therefore, the information which you need to specify both of them is in general, if there are independencies, if there are dependencies, less than the sum of the information needed in average to specify the outcome of each individual. I could have said that this is the average energy, it's an average value, this is the average value of minus of p, and it's the average bit number, so to say, if I made a logarithm in binary, to specify the outcome of the measurement of x. Now, this functional information can also be written as the entropy needed, the average information needed to specify x, minus the average information when you measure x and you are given the outcome of y. And just using these formulas, you can write it as an average value of a log. It's the log of the joint probability divided by the product of the two marginal probabilities. And from here you see immediately what you also could see from here, that if Pij, the joint probability, factorizes, then of course this is zero, so when this is independent, then I is zero, and what, well, what does see so clearly is that when they're not independent, then always this thing here is positive. It's never negative, and it is zero only when the x and y is independent. Now, another remark, assume that x and y are not continuous, Now you can make discrete random variables out of them by binning. So what you do is you divide your space into bins, and then these are the sums over the bins. Now, if you make this binning, of course you make an error if you estimate usual ratio between the bin variables, of course, and the true ones. So what you want to do is, at the end, you want to make the bin size to zero again. Now, if you do this in this formula, you end up with infinity. You have a logarithmic diversion with the bin size, because the weight, the probability between the bin size of size, let me see, delta x, is of course proportional to delta x if the density is continuous, and therefore you pick up here a logarithm of the bin size. Now this term here cancels out when you take this ratio. If, again, the densities are continuous. That means that for the neutral information, you can do what you cannot do for the general information. Namely, you can take the limit inside from zero, and you end up with an integral problem. When you write the analogous of the problem for the general information, you end up with what is called sometimes the differential information, but it has no real direct information theoretic interpretation. Now, some important properties of neutral information. First, from the construction is obvious symmetry. Never empty set, it's never negative, it's not negative, and it's positive whenever it's density that's factorized. Formally, this is true by Jensen's inequality, but I think the arguments which I've given her before should also convince you. Another thing is that if you take the mutual information and divide it by the total, this of course can only be done for the discrete case, because otherwise this is infinite.
Sorry, what is H?
H is the entropy.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I did write it, but I did not say that X is a scalar error. X can be itself multi-component. And therefore, when I write this down, this could be just X could be just X1, X2, and then X4. So this combination here is actually a distance that really satisfies the trivial inequality, and moreover, it's normalized. And this has, for many applications, some big advantage. Namely, if, let me see, x and y have much structure, there is much information needed to specify. Then you also expect, of course, that the neutral information, if there's much, well, then there will also be much dependency. If there's not much, if they're just very simple, then this will work, then this ratio will also fit. And therefore, this ratio is in many applications more useful than the neutral information itself. And as I said, if you write subtract one, this is a real distance. Now, another very important thing is, and again, this is not true for the shared, but it's true for a information. It's invariant under Moore's law. So again, let me assume x and y are continuous now, get away from discrete, but now in a continuous case, and I make the invertible transformation x goes to the function x and y also. I transform x and y separate. I don't make a joint transformation. Now, it's easy to see that the Jacobians related to this transformation just drop out, and the whole thing is invariant. Next thing, it's well known that if you have a distribution, and if you know its variance, a one-dimensional distribution, let me say its variance, then the distribution which maximizes the entropy given the variance is a Gaussian. It's strange that the same thing for mutual information was not known until quite recently. At least there was another way of any formal proof. But you can give it a proof, an exact proof. So, and this leads to a lower bound for the most information in terms of the covariances we specify the Gaussian. So here, C is the covariance matrix, and C, I are the diagonal elements. And then this thing here, which I haven't yet defined, is bound from the law. Now, what is this thing? This thing is what, at least in one community, and this community is the community of independent component analysis people, IA, I will give my main example later from this. These are called mutual informations. In other communities, mutual information is called something which has more complicated structure, more reminiscent of cumulant expressions. And the point is that you can have, let me say, if you have three variables, it's one, it's two, it's three, it's perfectly possible that I, 40, 20, 23, 3 is large, but at the same time, the mutual information between x1 and x2 is small, or even zero. The one between x2 and x3 is zero, and the one between x1 and x3 is zero. So if all pairwise mutual information are small, it does not mean that, so if the variables are independent pairwise, it does not mean that they are independent generalized. Moreover. And for this thing here, because this is the same definition you get this from before. Now this thing here has a further interesting nice property, which we call the grouping property. I have already said that given two random variables, you can just simply join them and formally define a combined random variable. And let me take x and y together and call the random variable w. Now, if you have this thing here, well, let me say three arguments. You can join x and y and form a z, w, and then you have the rest. And this thing here is very easy to do. Just from the definition, it's one line of joint. And it means just the mutual information between a bunch of variables can be decomposed into the mutual information within a group of variables and the mutual information between different groups. So you can make a hierarchical class decomposition of mutual information, which will be crucial for the application, for the first application of mutual information, which I will discuss. Maybe cluster. There are some further interesting things which I don't want to discuss, however, because I don't have spikes. And rather, I will go. Now, as I said, to my next point, and the next point is, as I said already at the beginning, that parallel to the shadow information theory, you have something which you might call algorithmic information. And that works in the following way. We're not talking now about random variables, we're talking about individual objects. And the objects are strings, but not the strings which very natural here, but what computer scientists call a symbol string. A string of symbols, sequence of symbols. A symbol is something, object of an alphabet, could be 0 or 1, but it could also be just a letter, or it could be an amino acid, or whatever. So, the object which I want to get information about is how these strings, of finite length, but in the I'm of course interested in the limit where the length is large. And I have to, at least at the beginning, consider explicitly the computer I'm working with. Now computer, you're perfectly okay to think of a PC or a workstation. Formally, has a universal computer, an individual computer, which can emulate any other computer, or this is called also formally the universal Turing machine. Now, the complexity, as it is usually called, of x relative to u is then the length, you can measure it in various ways, but simplest way bits, of the shortest program, which when input in u produces on u the string, or the screen of u the string x. Yeah? This is called the Kolmogorov complexity of x. Now there are a number of observations. The first one, or the first two are, that really this notion of complexity is not completely independent of Shannon keeping, as you see from the following two. The first is, when you take long strings, then when you long strings, the complexity will become independent of u. Indeed, it will become independent of u because, well, this is not engineering. The point is the following. You can emulate, as I said, any computer by another with an emulation program of finite length. That is, you can take the coding on u, add to it the emulation program, and then you can run it on any other computer. Now, when you take the 1 over n and the limit n to infinity, the length of the emulation program gets unimportant, and therefore this thing becomes independent of the computer. So this ugly dependence on the computer disappears when we take large objects, long sequences. The other observation is, and that's again non-trivial to prove, but it's proof, if x is a random withdrawal from a stochastic process with entropy h. Now I have to say what is the entropy of the stochastic process, but I said only what is the entropy of a single discrete variable. Now, for a stochastic process, essentially what you can think of, you look at lots of this sequence, and you assume that you have a statistic of block distance. So block is, I mean, just, let me see, n singles one after the other. So then you make statistics of them. And if the entropy of these block markers converges to the block length of infinity, then this is called the entropy h of the source of the transfer process, which describes, which generates this sequence. And then what you have is that the limit here in this for nearly all x is the limit of the complexity divided by n goes to the entropy per letter of your process. So actually, although the concepts are very different conceptually, they have, of course, some relationship, otherwise I wouldn't talk about it. Another point is the Kolmogorov complexity is not computable in the sense that you cannot give an algorithm which you can blindly use to put in a sequence and it will spit you out complexity. There's a very elegant argument using Turing's Hartree problem that shows that this cannot exist. But it does not mean that you cannot give estimates. And in particular, you can give very easily upper limits in the context. And this is very easy. Namely, well, when all these things were done some 20, 30, 40 years ago, it was not so obvious. But nowadays, everyone has a computer. He says, and on this computer, he has Zip, or BlueZip, or whatever. Compression algorithm. The compression algorithm is exact. What does it do? It takes a string, makes out another string, which, when fed into the decompressor, produces the original string. and the length of a compressed string is just an upper limit of the complexity of the original sequence. Now, the following, I will use length of compressed programs to estimate the complexity and therefore the amplitudes. This is rather delicate, but I should say this part, which I'm now going to discuss, is really, we are only coming to the detail. The first works on this were done by Lee and Vitani and by Bennett and others, and it goes as follows. First, you can now find also mutual information in this algorithmic context. Namely, you have two sequences, x and y, both have their same length, and you can, of course, concatenate them. Just write one after the other. And then you can consider the difference in the, I don't write the u here because, okay, I assume that they are long, and so you have to use so the complexity of x plus the complexity of y minus complexity of the joint. This is the same structure as we had in Shannon, and we had really very similar properties because although xy, the concatenation xy is not the same as the concatenation of x, and although c of xy is not the same as x, it can be shown, and this is a non-trivial thing, that the difference is subdominant in the long term minimum log n. That means the difference increases on the logarithmic limit n, while these objects typically increase linear length. So this is the leading approximation, symmetric, and it has all the properties of Shannon information up to terms for the log n. The main difference between the Shannon and the algorithmic versions, I should stress again, is that the Shannon version is the property of the stochastic variable. So if these are strings, then it's a property of a stochastic process. While C is a property of one realization of this stochastic process, but this realization doesn't have to be indeed a realization of a stochastic process, so it's a property of one object. Now let me assume that this X is really produced by a stochastic process, is produced by this process X. The difference is that then when you estimate C of X, well, as I said, I estimate the complexity by a compression algorithm. I take various compression algorithms and I take the best one which I can get, and then this is the best iteration which I can get. The estimate of H of X proceeds by an estimate of the distance of log. And they should basically give the same estimate. And this can be turned around. And this has led, of course, to a huge literature on entropy estimators. And where, on the one hand, you estimate entropies by log frequencies, on the other hand, you estimate entropies by compressing essentially the sequence. And I don't want to go into detail, but this is, I think, an interesting subject by itself, but it has not really the subject of the present talk. Now let me come to the first application. The first application is to fluid genetic trees. A fluid genetic tree is a tree where you have some species arranged in a tree-like structure so that you see that the descendants. In particular, we considered, and this is really work which we are thinking, following the lead of, as I said, Lee and Vitani, and others. So we consider 34 mitochondrial genomes of mammals. The mitochondria are some objects in the cell, essentially the power stations, so to say. And they have roughly between 16,000 and 18,000 bases there. So these are, these people took mitochondrial genomes because they are rather uniform, they don't contain much junk, and all species have roughly the same length, which is not true for the other rest of it. Now, we form an estimate for the arbor contributional formation. And, well, the following result use just a standard estimator, which seems to be a very good one, namely VZ2, one of these borrowed transformation compressors. But other authors have used here specific compressors for DNA sequences. And we use this localized distance, which one here?
Question? Is it easy to see that this object fulfills the triangle identity?
Yes. It's a one-page proof, which you find in the paper by me and collaborators, and it mimics exactly the proof for general entropies, which was given by a Spanish guy, Manzanaro.
Are there any bounds between those two distances?
Sorry?
Are there any bounds between those two distances?
Bounds?
Bounds, which is larger. I mean, this distance related to C, to complexity, and this distance related to Shannon.
Well, you can't say any bounds because you can't define the different situations. Well, let me put this way. Yeah, I can, of course, also say this X and this Y are representatives of random processes, and then I can try to estimate the shadow of the process. And then, in the limit of long sequences, they should be the same. But since this is always an upper bound, this is also typically a larger, I mean, sorry, not there. The difference is it's not bounded from the previous side, because it's a different, yeah? But, okay. So, now what do we do? The question, the point is, given these features, we want to form such a tree. And this tree, well, I don't know what it can be. For instance, here you have quartz, donkey, Indian, Reno, white tree. And they form a cluster. And indeed, the two Renos form a cluster, and the quartz and donkey. And here, the two seals, Tarma seal and Grace, the cat and dog. And you have here the monkeys, including the human. And, well,
so, how do you arrange the vertical scale?
Okay.
How about vertical scale?
Exactly. That's important. So, what do we do now? We want to cluster these genomes. What do? We have now these mitochondrial genes, genomes, and we estimate mutual information between them. And then we have now, since we have 34 genomes, we have the matrix, symmetric matrix, or roughly symmetric matrix, of 34 by 34 distances. And now we look for the smallest distance, for the smallest pairwise distance. In this case, it was either here or here. I don't know. Let's just say it's here. So between chimp and finch. Okay? Now what I do is, next step, I say chimp and pig machine, I make one, so to say, super species. Generalized chimp, and I replace the chimpanzee and the pig machine by the generalized. So I go from 34 species to 33 species.
So now the distance from another species to generalized KIMP is the minimum of the
sliders, or no. Let's see, you can do something like that. You can sit down and the structure of this algorithm is in principle a standard classification. And indeed, first of all, what you did is use some standard, some textbook classification. The beauty of the information is that we have such a natural way of defining the distances to the new quantities. Namely, the generalized distance, generalized distance, is again a DNA sequence. It's twice as long, so what? We normalize the distance by dividing by the total. So it's okay. So now it's a species like the other. And we just continue. Yeah? And this, what we call the grouping property, namely that you can decompose the mutual information into the mutual information within the cluster and between the cluster and the rest, means just when I replace this two species cluster by its prime, I just drop out the internal part and the whole structure remains the same. In particular, if you think about it, what you find is that the height of the nodes here is always given just by this distance. So here, for instance, this is 0.5 or 4 is the distance between the. Now here, the distance between the generation and the human is 0.6, and so on and so on. And this makes a beautiful tree just because of this clustering. I mean, it is this grouping.
To what extent this position is stable? I mean, I would think it would a bit change topologies if the heterogeneous material would look differently.
You make a good point. The whole thing is not state of the art as far as we usually treat it, okay? Because it's not extremely stable. The point is that even the best compression algorithms today are lousy on an absolute standard. And this mutual information is very small compared to what, if you make any decent assumption, should it be. I mean, heuristically. And therefore, the whole thing is not extremely robust. It is, typically what happens is that on the low level, so within, within these groups, it stays. But when you look at the lower range of groups, this is the best thing. It is not completely random. It gives a structure which goes systematically up to the highest. That's up. But still, it's not state of the art. The main interest is that it's very conceptual and simple, because you don't have to fiddle around with the distance between the center of the cluster and the rest of the world, because this is immediately given by this grouping. Now, let me come back to channel interpretation. And I want to discuss a few minor and one major applications where my random variables are continuous. And for that, I have first to find estimators for mutual information of continuous variables. And this is a non-trivial problem. I should say once again that also the estimation of entropies from data is non-trivial. But this is not the subject of my talk here. I can probably tell you. But here I want just question is I have two random variables. Why? And all I know about them is from finite samplings. So I have a finite sample of n pairs, x, y, 1, x, y, 2, etc. And I assume that the different samples are independent. They're all drawn from the same distribution, the joint variable x y. And I want to get an estimator for the mutual information. Now, what are the basic trappings to a neighbor? The first which comes to your mind is bidding. And the first which is bidding comes to mind, you just take a fixed grid and you count how many points fall in each box of the grid. And then you say, if you have ni points in a grid and you have n points altogether, you say ti is roughly this ratio. This is an estimate for the probability, and then you form ti dot ti and so on. Now, this is poor because this estimate is not exact for ni reflected. And typically, in your grid, some boxes will be very full, some will be not hardly empty, or not really empty. So, embedded strategy will be an adaptive grid where you make small boxes in which where density is high and large boxes where the density is low. And this is, so to say, one of the state of the art class of algorithms. It still leads to large geometric errors. It still has rather large statistic errors. Particularly, it's very difficult in high dimensions, because in high dimensions it's very hard to make a grid over the whole space, but at least it's fast. Now, another concept is kernel methods. Here you don't take a fixed grid, but if you have given several points, this is our illustration with the one dimensional sample, you have the measure points here, here, and here, you put some, could be Gaussian, could be parabola, whatever, some kernel over it. So you say that this point here contributed to your estimate of the density of this function. And then the total estimate is just the sum of it. Now, here you see immediately the main problem, namely, everything depends very much on the width of these kernels. If the kernels are too narrow, then essentially you have some delta peaks. And if you do the whole thing now in two dimensions because you want to see the dependencies, you have one delta peak here, one delta peak here, I mean, they will be completely independent. On the other hand, if you make the width too wide, you will smear out, you will not have no structure left, and you will overestimate the entropy, and you will underestimate the dependencies. So, yeah, large geometric errors, unless you know exactly the optimal width of the kernels, which in practical applications you rarely do. And so, I would say I don't like this either. And what I like, however, is estimators based on nearest neighbor statistics. Technically, I mean, there are estimators for Shannon entropy based on your neighbor statistics around since at least the early 70s. The idea is roughly the following. These are now, two dimensional, let me say, my points. And let me take, for instance, this point. And let me take the nearest neighbor, second nearest neighbor, etc. Now, the distance to, let me say, the kth, so let me say, fourth nearest neighbor, defines a sphere here, or a hypersphere. And this sphere is characterized by having exactly k, so exactly in this case, four points. But the total number of points is n. So you know that the statistical weight of this region is, up to fluctuations, 4 over n. And you know what is the size, so you can have the density estimate of the density here. Now, as I said, of course, it's obvious that there are fluctuations. And unfortunately, You can take exact this evaluation exactly in time. What you cannot take exactly in time are variations of the density. So if the density is not its full function, or not a constant, then the following estimator will make it an error. So the following estimator depends on the assumption that within the sphere characterized by your k near stable, density can be assumed as constant. And this estimator given by Kozachenko and Diamenko in the 80s is the following. The estimator for shadow entropy based on the k near stable contains the Dye gamma function, psi is the gamma function k, the Dye gamma function of the total number of points. It contains the phase space, the volume of the Euler sphere in dimension, and it contains an average, so to say, overall points of logarithm of epsilon. Yeah, we said that epsilon somehow, or epsilon to the d, that's why the d comes in here, somehow gives the volume and therefore gives an inverse density. And we wanted to make an average of a log of density, and that's why this graph appears. And this particular form you can derive it by taking the right fluctuations if you assume this space will be straight dependent. Now, if you are given this estimate, then you say, well, everything is fine. Everything is solved because if we have an estimator for the general entropy, we just take the difference, general to one variable plus the other, minus the joint, and this gives us an estimator for the neutral information. Now, unfortunately, this would be a very poor, or rather poor estimate. And the reason is the following. We have said that these estimates are not exact because they neglect variations of the density. So this estimator neglects variation of the density on a scale given by the distance to the k nearest neighbor, and since this is low dimensional, it's also low dimensional, it's high dimensional. So here the distance to the k neighbor is smaller than here, and also in the second term smaller than the third term. So in the third term, the distance to the k neighbor is much larger, and therefore here the corrections to this formula would be large, and they would not be canceled by the corrections here. So what do we want an expression where we don't have the same k here and here, but we want to have the same distance. So what we do is essentially following, we take a metric which is in the individual spaces. As you want, you can take any metric you want in the individual spaces, but in the joint space, it's just a product, I mean, it's just the maximum product, so to say. So the distance between this point and this point is just the maximum of the horizontal distance and the vertical distance. And then what you do is, in this here, two variants here, in this variant, I take a point, draw a square around it, with high dimensions, hypercube, which contains exactly k points, here k points 1, and then I count in the projection in this direction, and in this direction, I have here n y points, and I have here n x points. Here I have another variant where I take squares and I take two rectangles. So this is now the smallest rectangle which contains two points. Here's another situation where the smallest rectangle which contains two points is given by two different points, but here it's given by one from the corner. You have to work out these different cases, and you end up for these two things in two different formulas. And formulas, well, are roughly similar experience to the Kozachenko variant. Again, they contain the Dye gamma function. Now this is the one for the, oh god, I hope this is the one for the square. It contains this term here for number k. Okay, why not? And it contains average over gamma functions, where here of an x, so the number of points in the projection x, and y. And then you have all the diagonal functions. And as I said for the rectangular thing,
you average diagonal functions, or you average this brackets mean what?
Brackets mean average over all central points. You see, I took here a red point, and I looked at its neighbors. And I should repeat this for all red points. And this is the average. It's a sum over all n. Points. Of course, it's not an ensemble average because I don't have an ensemble average. Just this sum. Okay. So we have actually two versions. Now, what are the main properties? The main property is that, of course, this estimate has statistical errors in the sense that if I repeat them repeatedly with different samples, I get different estimates in the game. And sometimes they fall on the same side of the, or most of the time, of the true value, but sometimes they fall randomly on both sides, and the latter case are called statistical errors, the other case are called systematic. Now, it is pretty fast if you use efficient data structures, which you have also to do for these grid-based methods. It's fairly robust against outliers. You might ask, what happens if you're actually discretized? Most data in nature are taken with finite precision, so you have actually not continuous random variables, but discrete ones. Well, and that means you don't know which is the case neighbor because there are two points which have the same distance, and which one is the one you take. In that case, what we found is we get good results, which are just randomized by adding a very, very small, a tiny noise amplitude, which just breaks the degeneracy without adding any other thing. And the interesting thing is, in general, it has much smaller errors. But if x and y are independent, it seems that the error, systematic error, is exactly zero. Now, this is a non-trivial statement, because none of the other estimators use this. And this is here an illustration with simulations done for Gaussians. R is the correlation coefficient, 0.0 is uncorrelated, 0.9 is quite high with correlation. Here is one over the number of points, and here is the average of the estimator over millions of samples, tuples, minus the analytic expression for a Gaussian. And what you see is what we all curves have errors in the order of 1% or smaller. The curve for uncorrelated is perfectly flat, and if you look closer, the errors are typically 10 to the minus 5 here, and since this was with really, this is actually statistically error which we expect. And this is done with here, well, see here, one of the n is, so this is 50 points, this is something like 25 points. I should say that any other estimator would give absolute nonsense. And we don't know really, we have no hint why it seems, we checked that it's independent of a number of other independent in zero independent variables. There's no hint why this happens. There's no symmetry involved. There's no we make the derivation of this. We have evident errors which we make. And okay. Nevertheless, the error is not only small, but it's also zero when it's independent. We have tested how the error depends on the number of neighbors which you want when you take k small, so you take only small neighborhoods, then you have a small systematic error because you test down to very small displays, and you have a higher resolution. Once you have for quadratic situations, you can check all these events, errors on various other things, and so the whole thing works also in high dimension. Nothing said here. X and Y dimensional, and also for high dimensions, you can take a lot of those arguments.
So I can see the standard for those kind of universe of curves. Do you understand that? Have you really seen properly the models?
We don't really know. It's not universal in a strict sense. And it depends on the slide. I mean, the point is, of course, as I said at the beginning, if I make a homeomorphism, then the multi-relation should change. So what I can do is, in particular, I can make a transformation so that it depends on the cost. And then we get the same algorithm. It works, you know, it produces estimates which are essentially the same. Most of them have this structure, but, well, they have this structure, but they have no real explanation. Now, the first smaller application, showing you that these things are not quite trivial, is to a problem called genomics. Now, you don't have to read all of this. These are data published in the literature of the DNA, from DNA genes, where you had about 300 different, slightly different yeast variants. So you have yeast and then has one mutation in one gene, or a mutation in another gene, or grown in a rather acid environment, or grown in an environment with urea or whatever. So 300 slightly different genomes. And they measured the expression rate of 6,000 order of magnitude, 5,000 something, 800 or whatever, different genes, or actually open reading frames. And so for each open reading, pair of open reading frames, now you have roughly 300 different expression vectors for the mutant. And so we can estimate the mutant information, and we can estimate just the linear correlation. And we can also subtract from the mutant information, from the estimated, the expression which is expected for a Gaussian with the measured correlation. Now, if everything was okay, our data should never go below zero, because the mutual information is non-negative. Of course, if we had an unbiased estimator, well, weakly biased estimator, and we have statistical information, then sometimes they must go zero. So somehow these negative values here are an indication of the statistical fluctuations of our estimate. Fortunately, if you see, the error is here, most of the points are positive, so which means that the emotional information captured more structure than the correlation. And then we have some very strange here. And if you have here a bunch of genome or green frame pairs, which are already strongly correlated, by the way, this is the linear correlation, but the mutual information is even stronger. And we have not really looked into the data what these are. None of us was a biologist. But this is typically what you could do. But instead of doing this, I want to come to my last example. I have how much? Maybe this five? Oh, this is supposed to be the biggest application. And it's mutual information based. Well, most people call it independent component analysis, but we want to stress that actually the components we get are DC dependent or independent, therefore we call it MILCA, for mutual information based, independent, at least independent component analysis. Now, what is independent component analysis? And I have already said many of these things in the beginning, so I don't have to repeat this. So often you have the problem that a magnet signal is in position to several sources. And you want to decompose the sources. And in particular, you don't want to assume that that feature already known it. And that is called blind source separation. That is, you want these are the ancient sources, and you want to find how the sources are superposed, just from the measurements itself. Now, obviously, this is only possible if the sources have statistics, and if they're not strongly correlated. Now, the simplest possibility is that your sources are linearly superimposed, that the sources are strictly independent from each other, that the number of channels is linear, and by channels, I use this terminology from ECG analysis, from electrocardiogram analysis. Electrocardiogram, we have here, here, typical electrogram has 8 channels, and in this way you could disentangle it with the method which I want to discuss here in sources. And now the last thing here, it may be written in a rather obscure way, so please forget it, but the point is essentially that if you represent, so to say, your analysis with different tuples, so in the case of ECG, 8 tuples, and these are the measurements at different times, and so this means essentially that there are two time structures because the measurements at different times are independent. So, this situation can be described by the following, namely, with your measurements, xi, channel I, the time t, are at linear superposition with the matrix, which is independent of time, on of the sources. And since I and k are equal because the number of sources and the number of channels are the same, w is a symmetric, is a square matrix, and moreover, I assume it's not singular. So this is, I assume everything which is needed to be nice. And in that case, you would say, well, it's obvious what you do is, you just invert. So you say S is just the inverse of W times X. And how do you find the inverse? Well, you find it so that the different sources are independent. And then everything depends on what means independent. And one thing which you could use, and which I think you already will appreciate that I won't use, is the linear correlation. Now, if you use this, if you use the linear correlation as a measure for independence, then everything, since you multiply it with the matrices, everything you will make linear, essentially what you do is you make a principal component analysis. You diagonalize essentially the covariance tensor by W. And so, principal component analysis is when you use just the correlation. But, once again, correlations in the sense of the statistician, so second order correlations, are not everything. And here, a graphic illustration, this is a column of points. And it is supposed to be a square. Rotated out of this rotation. And you rotate this a homogeneous square as much as you want, you will always end up with a diagonal covariance matrix. But of course, x and y is not independent, because if you know that x is here, then you know that y cannot be up there or down there, it must be in this regime. Which here, you don't. So here they are rooted. So that means, in the principle of component analysis, you have still a rotation. The outcome of the principle of component analysis is not specified up to a rotation. And essentially what you do is, you use information beyond the set of statistics for finding this last bit of the rotation. That is essentially, in a nutshell, not exactly, but principle, the idea of independent component. Again, I mean, the outcome of independent component is not completely unique. You still have computation freedom, you still have least parallel access freedom, but okay, these are all my details. The point is that a typical strategy for independent component analysis, you make first a principal component analysis, you scale the axis so that the covariance factors of the sources take after the principal component analysis. It's just the unit matrix. This is called a pre-white leaf. And then you use some additional information, whatever you have, to minimize some residual dependencies. And there is the literature. This whole concept started around 1980 with Newton et al. There is now textbooks, for instance, a very readable textbook by Ivar Ivan et al. That in, if you want, you can download a lot of algorithms, and I don't want to go into the time, but I think you will not be surprised that what we do is essentially we use our estimated mutual information to estimate the most important components. And this we call basic milk-out. Basic milk-out is it estimates the mutual information of the sources and then rotates until the minimum. And okay, that's the basic thing because we can do a lot of more things. One thing is we can make significant tests, namely we can see if we now choose rotations different from the one, how much does the situation deteriorate? If it does not deteriorate, then obviously the source would result one that's significant, and any other linear combination would be as good. The next thing is we can make tests of whether our sources are really independent. So what we do is we can check a pairwise distribution and check whether they are really zero. Now, I should say that our algorithms in this field do not really estimate the mutual information with sufficient precision that they could really say quantitatively this is large or this is small. Now we have really a quantitative estimate, and we can say, okay, this is, let me say, for one pair, larger than some exact threshold, and then we say these two are really not independent. And we can, in particular, then use for our optimal solution this clustering algorithm, which I discussed before. The fact that these are now mutual information, not in the algorithmic context, but in the general context, makes no difference, essentially. Well, it makes a difference, but I have no time to go into details here. And what you can do is you can find clusters of sources which are not independent. And then, at the last step, what you can do is you can reconstruct the confusion of these clusters of these multi-dependent sources, multi-component sources, and see what they would have contributed to the original signal. And the last step, we can consider, not the last step, the new last step, we can consider, again, instantaneously, see? But we say we don't want to minimize only the dependencies of the source of equal terms, but maybe there's some time structure, and maybe one source at a later time is correlated with another source, with an earlier time. And it's straightforward, the basic principle. The algorithm becomes, of course, more and more tedious and more useful these things to minimize the mutual information between such delay vectors. You won't know this concept here, but this is a well known concept from the time series analysis. And the very last step is you can assume also that the mixing itself has two delays. So when you have here your sources, the demix, the measure values, the sources are obtained by taking here delays. Saying that, well, maybe this algorithm gives you a better choice, and then you just have to take a sufficient number of such superpositions, and you then assume the mutual information between all of them has become meaningful. Now, application, and we apply these to various things. One thing was just some test examples, other was spectra, infrared spectra of some mix of chemical substances. What I want to discuss here, the only thing, is an ECG of a pregnant woman. So you have the woman, you have the fetus, and you have various sources of noise. And you have eight channels, and you have here the traces. You see here this is the first trace of the woman, but here you have trace of the woman, which looks rather different. And here you have something where you have these two things in between, and this is just where you see the heartbeat of the fetus. Now, with any of these numerical analyses, and in particular with what we call basic lambda, you get, if you just make a linear combination of these, typical output where some traces are rather nice. But this is the mother. Here you have one trace which is faster, which is always the fetus. But then you have something which is noise. Then you have something where you don't know. Okay. So it's good, but it's not perfect. If we do, however, the following. We do a delay embedding. Then we say, we take three successes. The number three was rather arbitrary. So three successive measurements at each channel. And say these are, so to say, the three different coordinates of a point, of a point in three dimensions. Then all together we have 8 or 6 from the 24 now channels. And we can decompose it into 24 sources. And then we can make a clustering, and you see here such a dendrogram as we saw before. And you see very nicely that there are some gouges here. So this is various noise. And then you have PR of the mother, obviously, and here the baby. And now, and so after we have done this dendrogram, we can arrange them, and we arrange them such as the temple here, and here the fetus, and you see exactly what this was correct. The mother has the slow rhythm, the fetus has the fast one. And now finally, as I said, I can erase, for instance, everything here, the fetus and all the noise. And I can reconstruct the original signal, or I can do the inverse transformation, just superimposing the various contributions of the mother, and I can also do it alternatively, take away the mother and the noise, and just put the child to the original traces. And here is the end result. So the first trace was part. First uppermost trace is part of this trace. Yeah? And you see the heart of the mother here, here the fetus, but here you see some heart of the family. Okay. Now this is with a more or less standard independent component analysis. You see that the separation is much better, the fetus is much cleaner. But here, this is our best thing. And here you see, you get a reconstruction when the fetus is practically perfect. There's no trace of the mother's seed. Well, of course, there's also no trace of the fetus. Okay, I think I have to stop here. I hope to have shown you that the concept of mutual formation is not only useful in the sense that it has a wide scope, but it really can be applied to a wide range of problems. And these problems were not all pure physics, but of course, okay, complex systems. Thanks. These people are part of students, and they do write quite sophisticated data analysis. Definitely not this one, but this is recent, but I don't know really what the example is. But this is one of the applications, yes. Except that there, when they have just noise and tape and one data stream, that's a little bit simpler than if you have different data streams. But it's the same basic problems.